Governor Holcomb fights over a story alleging interference in a worker's safety investigation. Todd Houston will be the next speaker, plus a potential increase in the smoking and vaping age, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending December 6th, 2019.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, Governor Eric Holcomb is embroiled in a struggle with Reveal and the Indianapolis Star after he sent them cease and desist letters over reports he pressured a state safety inspector into reducing penalties against Amazon. Holcomb's letters tell the media outlets to retract and correct stories alleging he pressured a safety inspector to clear Amazon of involvement in a worker death. IU Maurer School of Law's Joseph Tomain says those letters could be the first step toward a defamation suit.
Before somebody files a lawsuit for defamation, they have an obligation to request a retraction.
Holcomb would face an uphill battle in such a suit. Tomain says defamation against a public figure requires what's called actual malice, meaning they have to prove the publisher either knew the information was wrong or recklessly disregarded whether it was true or false. Holcomb denies any involvement in the Amazon investigation. What should we make of these allegations and Holcomb's denials? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Elise Schrock, Republican Jennifer Hollowell, John Schwanes, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Elise Schrock, this was an unusually vehement response from Eric Holcomb. What should we make of that part of it?
I think many people were surprised, and I'm not sure it's gone over as well as he may have hoped. In the past, you have seen Nikki had a great report on a former cease and desist that had been sent by the governor that had to do with his image. This is a little bit different than that. WFYI's All In did a great report where they went back and talked to that reporter from Reveal. I think that there was a very long investigation into what happened on the reporter's end. I think they did their due diligence. They went through legal. This wasn't an ad hoc report that was just thrown up on the internet. This was a real report that was done. They're standing by it. So I don't think that this move is maybe falling in the right way for the governor.
Does it seem like he's overreacting to this?
I don't think so. When someone prints something that's completely false, you can't just let it stand. So I think it's an appropriate response. This isn't a situation where someone wrote an article and you don't like the way they've characterized something or who they've quoted or how they've framed it. This is printing something that's utterly false. And they have produced no backup to say when these things took place that they're alleging, a meeting. Anyone who's been around the governor knows that this is not something that he would do. And so I think it's an appropriate response. I think it's really irresponsible for the Indianapolis Star to essentially copy-paste this without doing their own due diligence. They haven't been able to counter with anything that they can't prove it. And I think that, unfortunately, it's not good for journalism to do something like this, especially at the local level. Like, I think right now people probably look at national media in a different way than they look at local media, and there's more trust of local media, but this cuts away at that trust, and I think it's very bad for the Indianapolis Star, and I think it was an appropriate response.
John, I want to ask specifically about the Star's role in this, because you could look at this as they simply printed a wire report, no different than they do the Associated Press or something, or Reuters, or anything else like that, but is this the same as simply pulling something off the wire and putting it on your front page, or is this a little different, and so they are in a little bit of more hot water than they normally would.
It's a great question, and it can be answered, I guess, framed in several ways. A legal, strictly legal interpretation or framework, which I think would yield one answer, and then perhaps the broader question about image, credibility,
trust
yeah. within a community that you serve, maybe a little different answer. I think in terms of legal answer, I don't see anything actionable here. You have somebody who's on the record who claims to have been in the room and seen this. I mean, this is not somebody who's hiding behind having his or her voice modulated and hiding behind a screen. This person is out there. The report says this person claims such, such, and such. I think, again, I'm not a First Amendment attorney, but I would guess that this would not, the governor would not prevail ultimately if it's on that question. The more nuanced issue here is what Jennifer's talking about, which is when you have the hometown paper, if you will, the capital city paper, the paper of record, what additional due diligence is required. I'm sure that the Star would say it did its due diligence, and again, I think legally courts would say that's the case, but it's with that little asterisk that my question is offered, or my answer is offered.
I think the discussion over this so far has been mostly about this sort of fight between Eric Holcomb and Reveal and the Star, but there's reporting in here that goes well beyond that.
Yeah, I mean, the fact is that the one thing that the governor's office is really pushing back on is whether he himself was in a meeting with this gentleman. And they don't give a date for this meeting, which I think is a very big problem with the reporting. I mean, who doesn't remember the date you were in a meeting with the governor? However, if you just reframe this story completely without Holcomb in it, just act like that wasn't even part of it, they have an on-the-record recording with a key, you know, person in DOL under Holcomb who said, we're going to manipulate your reports to clear Amazon. Hope you're okay with that.
And blame the person who had
passed
away,
said,
alleging
they
were on drugs.
He was probably on drugs when they knew that they had a toxicology report that showed he wasn't. So, I mean, on one hand, Eric Holcomb's doing great because he's sort of distracted everyone from the irrefutable parts of that by picking up on one really problematic instance.
All right, well, Fisher's Republican Todd Houston will be the next Speaker of the Indiana House after his GOP colleagues named him heir apparent to retiring Speaker Brian Bosma at a private meeting this week.
Houston will serve alongside Bosma in the 2020 session as Speaker-elect, learning on the job before Bosma retires. Houston says he's grateful and thankful to take on the job.
The core fundamentals of running a house that runs functionally, that we deal with each other in a respectful manner, all those things, I think, from an outside perspective, I hope look very, very largely the same.
Bosma says he's confident the state is in good hands with Houston's leadership.
That important stability, I think, is really critical. And I'm very confident that Representative Houston is going to bring that same sense of stability.
Houston is a senior vice president at the College Board, which administers the SAT. He previously served as chief of staff to controversial state superintendent Tony Bennett.
General Hollowell, what do you expect from Speaker-to-be Todd Houston?
I'm excited about it. You know, Representative Houston is a very principled, genuine person. He's very intellectual. I think that he's open-minded and will listen to views from all different, you know, parties and backgrounds and perspectives, which I think is helpful. And in his work, I mean, I just think he's been really dedicated and not, you know, he's not just decided. He's very open-minded and willing to listen to people. I think that will serve him well. He obviously has a lot of leadership skills and is kind of the next generation of leaders in this in the State House, which is also exciting, and he has the respect of the caucus and I think members across the aisle as well, as evidenced by the fact that this seemed to be a pretty easy decision for folks to make.
Yeah. I noted that Houston, his role in sort of education policy, both with his current job and past jobs, that's raised some eyebrows among education activists, and there might be something going on with education this session. I don't know. Some people wearing red shirts might have hinted at that a couple weeks ago. What influence do you think his background will have on his reception as Speaker?
I think there'll be some background, but I think one of the most interesting parts of this for me is that he is from a district that is becoming much more moderate, if not turning a little bit more on the blue side. So he's going to have to listen to all sides. He is in, you know, he's in a vulnerable area of the state right now. He's going to have the ties to the purse strings for his caucus. If he's vulnerable, I mean, they're going to have to use resources there. At the same time, right before right, in an election year, in a short session, he's going to also have to tee up enough pretty conservative legislation for the rest of his caucus that's running in different parts of the state. I'm very interested in seeing how this dance is done, and I guess only time will tell.
I want to say on the education piece, though, if you want to talk about the background, I think you also need to consider the fact that his entire family went to public schools, Hamilton Southeastern Schools. Sure. He served on the school board. His wife was a teacher. I mean, he has a strong experience and commitment in public education.
I want to ask about something that Elise just mentioned, the idea of this is not a safe, he is not coming from a safe seat. Certainly, and something he's talked about recently. He's confident he'll win it, of course. But do you think him being the next speaker, and actually when he'll be running, he will be the Speaker of the House, right. Do you think that helps or hurts?
I think it helps. I mean, the fact is, money flows to whoever the speaker is, because that's...
It hasn't necessarily needed to flow to Brian Bosma for a long time.
Correct, but he's always been a big fundraiser for the caucus, right. and so I think that definitely helps him, because he won't even be elected at that point. He will be the speaker, he will control the agenda that next year, and obviously interests from various sides of all issues will want to be in front of him.
Todd Huston comes into this job with less legislative experience than Brian Bosma did back when he first became speaker in 2005, and certainly when he became speaker again in this unbroken streak since 2011. Huston talked about leaning more on his leadership team, but how difficult is that job going to be, assuming that the balance in the House stays close to the same where it is right now, even if they do.
It'll be tough. Even if he had, it was this freak of nature that had 100 years of legislative experience, it would still be a tough position because of what Elise said. When you have so many different factions within your caucus, some people who are not willing to, freshmen who are not willing to sit back and be seen and not heard, people who have an agenda and say, this is my issue, I'm going to fight, I'm not going to compromise, you got to herd all those individuals and all those thoughts. That's tough. I wouldn't discount, though, even though he didn't have as much legislative experience per se, I think what will benefit him is government experience. And the fact that he is someone who is seen as having earned his stripes. He ran for a local school board, won, served. He worked in state government, as you noted, for the Department of Education. So even though he wasn't a voting member of the Indiana House of Representatives at that point, there still was the notion of public service, an appreciation of the institutions. And that's what I think will serve him best. The speaker has to be an institutionalist. It has to be somebody who appreciates the rules and why things are done the way they are, the history that got us here. And I'm not sure that every member of the General Assembly certainly would want to heed those protocols and rules and would probably be willing to take a lighter in a public torch session, burn the rules.
But Todd Huston doesn't seem like that.
He is not that. He is, I think, somebody who, again, appreciates the past and the process, and that'll serve him well.
Well, the current House Speaker, Republican Brian Bosma, says he will personally push in the 2020 session to increase the legal smoking and vaping age in Indiana from 18 to 21.
Health groups and the Indiana Chamber of Commerce have long pushed to raise the smoking and vaping age, but it hasn't gotten far in the legislature. Bosma himself was opposed to it for years, in part, he said, because he didn't think it fair that Hoosiers could join the military at 18 but be banned from buying cigarettes. He says now his mind's been changed.
The armed forces themselves have asked us to do this. They don't allow the recruits to smoke in boot camp.
Bosma says the vast majority of his caucus will back raising the smoking and vaping age.
Nikki Kelly, this isn't the first time there's been a push to change the legal smoking age. What makes this time different?
Honestly, I think the vaping issue makes it different. I don't think they would go anywhere near raising the age on cigarettes to 21. But this epidemic and these illnesses, the amount of youth vaping we're seeing really has people freaked out, and I think fairly. And so they can't sort of do one without the other, without, you know, it really showing
that
a level
both,
playing
right.
field.
Yeah. We're 2020 session, going into an election year, often the conventional wisdom being that lawmakers might try to avoid really prickly social issues that might get people fired up and risk something at the ballot box. Does that not apply here, or is this just one they're going to try and push through anyway?
I think they will, because now the speaker, the outgoing speaker, has put his name and his reputation behind it. Now, to your
easier
point,
easier to do that when you're out voting.
I was just going to say, you read my mind. Whether he would have done that if he didn't have the latitude or the luxury of being able to thumb your nose at those who might say, better mind your P's and Q's, we have an election coming up. I don't know where he would have been on the issue. I mean, we know where he's been in the past.
Yeah.
So there is a bit of a change in his shift in his position. Whether it's tied to that or not, I don't know. But think about the groups that have been seeking this for a long time. There has been millions of dollars. I mean, this some of the largest coalitions with every kind of household name organization that our viewers and listeners would all recognize have been fighting for these kinds of changes for now a number of years. Yeah. It didn't have the kind of vote, the champion that it needed to carry this and prevail in the General Assembly itself. Now it does, and I think that will make sure that it's getting to the governor's desk.
Of course, the real question is, I suppose, the Senate more than the House even, but that'll be... We'll talk about that on future shows, I'm sure. Let me ask you this, though, and when we talk about considering that it is an election year. We saw at the federal level when the administration was contemplating changes to vaping regulations that vaping groups and vapers or whatever they want to call themselves, you know, threatened, you know, electoral action if you dare touch our products. I'm not hearing the same sort of threats here in Indiana. Should lawmakers expect them?
Should they
worry about them, I suppose, more importantly?
I think there will be some. There have been some in the past, but it's not as big of a number. It really, frankly, I think, comes from different groups. I mean, it's the big companies that are making money off these products that can fuel that. I think Nikki's exactly right as to why we're in this place. We can't go back in time, but I sure wish we could, and we could have saved lots of people from being hooked on these products that they're now hooked forever. We have... if not a generation, we have several years of teenagers now who are all addicted to nicotine, and studies show that if you vape, you're four times more likely to smoke cigarettes, and it's horrible. And so I think the governor and others have signaled that they are open to this, which is really a big new day, but it's part of the kind of overall health package that the governor is interested in.
And I think the T21 conversation, it goes beyond what's been happening at the state. You've seen Senator Mitch McConnell, who is from a area of the country that produces tobacco, and he's even moved on this issue. So, you know, whether it is, as John was saying, an evolution of the speaker's, you know, outgoing circumstances, I mean, it could be that. He also has cover from major leaders in his party on this as well, and I think we may see federal action on this.
Yeah, I think the important thing, though, is I think they're tired of waiting for federal action, because flip that coin, who knows if it's ever going to actually happen. Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, should Indiana raise the minimum legal age to smoke and vape from 18 to 21? A yes or B no. Last week's question, what effect are House impeachment hearings having on President Trump's chances at re-election? 16% of you say it'll have a positive effect, 54% say a negative one, while a third of you say there's been really little to no effect. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Will a small plurality of respondents in the annual Ball State Hoosier survey have a positive view of Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill, despite five women who accused the Republican state official of sexual misconduct?
38% of people in the Hoosier survey approve of Attorney General Curtis Hill, while just 15% disapprove. Ball State political scientist Charles Taylor says the annual poll had never before asked about a statewide elected official other than governor or U.S. senator, and he says one of the surprising things about Hill's numbers is his high name recognition.
There were only 11% that responded that they hadn't heard of him. The biggest number of people that didn't express an opinion just didn't express an opinion.
But Taylor says that's likely in part because the Hoosier survey polls 600 adults, not limiting it to likely or even registered voters. Taylor says he expects Hill's approval numbers to change as the campaign for attorney general heats up.
John Schwanis, are you a little surprised at these numbers?
Maybe not, because of when it's being done here. We haven't seen a lot of the ramp up yet of commercials that might shine a light in a very public fashion on some of these allegations of impropriety that might remind people about the conduct that if they have forgotten or didn't know about it in the first place. I think what's at work here maybe is some what I guess the pollsters and researchers would call social desirability. If I looked at the way the question was worded, and the question was, do you approve of the job that Curtis Hill is doing as Attorney General of the state of Indiana? And then people volunteered for themselves, 11%, I believe it was, that they've never heard of him. I think
That's a small number who say they haven't heard of him.
Right,
of
course, but
for that kind of statewide.
But I know this is not what pollsters do, but if you asked, did 600 adults name Indiana's Attorney General?
That's not 11%.
You might get some people, you get more people saying it's William Barr, who happens to be the U.S. Attorney. Our viewers and listeners know that, but for the less knowledgeable ones, he'd probably get a higher number of people thinking he's the Attorney General. I think there's it's a lack of knowledge more than anything, and people don't want to acknowledge that they, especially with the question being worded the way it is, they'll just go with the flow and say, yeah, I think he's doing all right.
Yeah, I'm not saying this is telling us exactly how the election is going to go, certainly far from that, nor would the folks at Ball State say the same thing. There's a lot of volatility, presumably, in these numbers, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and new stuff will still come out. We still don't know whether Curtis Hill, will be disciplined. And I mean, his name is still going to be earning headlines, and that's probably why, frankly, a lot of people knew him. I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean they knew him because of positive things, but they've seen his name in the headlines.
He's also the king of putting a press release out and taking credit for all sorts of areas that may or may not pertain to his office. So I guess he's getting his name out there, but when it comes down to it, whether it's a Republican primary or when we put up an opponent against him, should he make it through the primary, the curtain's going to be pulled back, and Hoosiers aren't going to like what they see if they have not heard what's been going on so far. And I think that has stayed largely within state house circles, but that's going to change.
Yeah, as you look at these numbers, if you're somebody who's interested in seeing Curtis Hill be defeated, whether at the Republican convention or in the general election, are you looking at these numbers and going, there's a lot of room to create a narrative here?
Oh, yeah. These polls are meaningless at this point. I mean, they really are. If you took a survey the way campaigns and parties are going to take a survey and tested 10 questions of, from the testimony against Curtis Hill and allegations, and then after those 10 questions, ask people what they think about him, you're going to get a very different answer. And essentially what that is the campaign playing out. So people don't know today. I don't expect them to know today. No. But they're going to in the fall, which is why we have to figure out who our nominee is going to be.
Well, Indiana manufacturer Cummins announced recently it plans to lay off 2,000 employees globally early next year.
Cummins wouldn't say how many of the cuts will come from Indiana, but it notes that those laid off will be salaried positions, not union jobs. The Hoosier manufacturing giant says a decrease in demand is spurring the layoffs. Meanwhile, Indiana has lost nearly 11,000 manufacturing jobs total through October of 2019.
Lynn Schrock, how worried should we be in the larger economic context?
I think that any time an announcement is made from a group who is seen as a really great, quite frankly, corporate community member and a business partner for Indiana, it does start to worry your everyday working Hoosiers a bit. And it's not like they're starting off on sound feet more than usual. So I think announcements like this do have a bit of a chilling effect. It could be a tough road for Hoosier workers.
Budget makers this past session kind of were hinting at caution because they're worried about what the economy might do over the next 2 years. Do these kind of numbers, not just from Cummins, but overall the manufacturing jobs lost so far in the state this year, give a lot of credence to that caution?
Well, I mean, obviously it's disappointing and not something we want to see in any sector. Some of these things have been forecast for a while. At least, we know manufacturing is changing. We know some of these industries are changing, and we have to adjust with it. But keep in mind, we still have an incredibly strong economy in Indiana and incredibly low unemployment. And there are a lot of jobs, in the tech industry, there was 85% growth in Indiana and forecast more. And a lot of the folks at Cummins, these are salaried positions, they may fit nicely into some of these new tech jobs that are not, just coding. There's all kinds of jobs in the tech industry that those folks could fit to.
All right, well, finally, Speaker-elect Todd Houston was asked this week if he planned any rule changes in the House, with Speaker Bosman joking he would move the press as far away as possible. But Jennifer Hollowell, if you became Speaker, what's a rule you would institute for the Indiana House of Representatives?
This is really hard. I'm torn between something that has to do with posting amendments online advance, or asking legislative assistants to respond to scheduling requests within 48 hours.
Can I remove a rule?
Yes.
Okay, I want to take out that stupid bill pending rule.
Yes.
Because, you know, like the Senate does this just fine. They suck it up and they vote on issues all the time, and the House kind of hides behind that rule.
Yeah, that's true. I'm with you on that one. I would vote for Nikki Kelly for Speaker of the Indiana House. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Elise Schrock, Republican Jennifer Hollowell, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/iwir, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.